This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Bread tags, pizza savers, so those little plastic stools that are in the middle of your pizza so that your cheese doesn't stick to the top of the cardboard, fruit stickers, balloons, lollipop sticks, soy sauce, fish, plastic bags with handles. They're just a few of the plastic items that will be phased out in New South Wales from as early as next year. Now, this has been years in the making in New South Wales, and they've marked 15 of those very small but very harmful products. We'll speak to a woman who's been instrumental in making this happen, and she believes not only will it work, but she also believes that Victoria can do the same. So what do you do with those plastic bread tags? I don't know what to do with mine. I've just got this big pile that's sitting there and I'm wondering, hopefully one day there'll be a solution. What about those small annoying fruit stickers? What do you do with those when you peel them off? Where do you put them? And can we survive without these small little plastic items so that marine life can actually survive?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So are there other ways to tie up your bread other than a plastic bread tag? What about the fruit stickers? Do you really need fruit stickers on your fruit? Are there other ways to identify that fruit? Those small bits of plastic that we use all the time that maybe we think is so small that we don't take it into consideration. It is killing marine life and our waterways. And a study that has been years in the making in New South Wales is actually going to try and implement real change. So will it work? And what are we doing here in Victoria? Lots of texts coming in. What about dental floss? And another that says those little whippersnipper plastic cords, it gets chopped up and thrown into the environment with every use. Well, the director and the CEO of Tangaroa Blue Foundation is Heidi Tate. And Heidi, you have been working tirelessly pretty much your entire working life, but in particular over the last couple of years, you've been working on a project to target that unnecessary, hard to recycle plastic products, those small bits of plastic that we use in our everyday life that has a huge impact on our marine life. What is different about this particular project that you've been working on?
Well, I think the most exciting thing is that it's looking at data to inform policy and using then the ongoing data to measure the impact of that policy change. It's really easy sometimes for policy to get changed based on public sentiment, you know, what's popular for the day. But if we really want to be targeting the types of items that are impacting our environment, we really need the data to show us what they are. And then if we implement a change, we want to make sure that we're actually seeing a reduction. And that's why we're so excited about the work that's being done in New South Wales.
Quite often, Heidi, when we hear about bans, whether it be the plastic bag ban or coffee cups or single-use plastics, we actually take a lot of that information now with a little bit of a roll of our eyes in, is it really a ban? Is it going to work? Why am I still being offered plastic bags? Does a ban ever really stick? What will make this different, do you believe?
Well, I think that the framework that was used in New South Wales came from the science side, which means that there was a process called the Marine Debris Threat and Risk Assessment, where the items that were found along the coastline were identified in 20-kilometre kind of square grids all the way down the coastline. And a lot of that data came through our Australian Marine Debris Initiative database, which has, you know, 20 years of data. So it really shows you that long-term trends. And then the marine estate was looked at. So, you know, what are the things that we use and we value in our marine environment, whether it's wildlife or public amenity or, you know, the well-being that we get from a clean environment, and all of those things kind of got overlapped. And so out of that, we were able to see where and what was impacting different parts of the coastline to try and inform this. And I'll give you a really good example was, you know, one of those items that got flagged as being, you know, in the top 15 was balloons. And when we looked at the current legislation in New South Wales, it actually allowed you still to go and release 19 balloons, but 20 balloons was illegal. And so by looking, you know, which is kind of crazy to start with, but if you look at then at the data and then you look at the current policy setting, it gives you that evidence that you need to say, okay, well, we need to obviously update this because, you know, 19 balloons are just as harmful as one balloon. So why are we allowing any to be released at all? And so that's one of the changes that we're seeing.
I feel like we've been talking about banning balloons forever.
Yes, we have. It's a no-brainer, really. You know, it's not only about the balloon itself and the ribbon and the plastic clips and all the rest, but why are we using helium, which is a finite resource that we need for, you know, medical uses and other really important uses? Why are we using them to fill up a balloon so it goes into the sky and then it bursts and then it litters our environment? It just never made any sense to me.
It's quite distressing now when you do see balloons up in the sky or you see people walk out with huge, big handfuls of balloons for birthdays, but it's something ingrained in our lives, you know, and with celebration and with times of joy. Stay with us. Hayley Tate is with you, Director and CEO of Tangaroa Blue Foundation, who has been a part of the working group in New South Wales, the Marine State Risk Assessment, to try and bring in and implement a ban on those small everyday plastics, everything from balloons to those little pizza, I call them pizza seats because they look like little stools in the middle of your pizza. It might even be lollipop sticks as well. But Rosemary's in Safety Beach. Good morning, Rosemary.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say?
Oh, just that last year, you know, I go to Baker's Delight sometimes and get bread, and it's interesting that the first thing the girls give you is a plastic bag, and I say, can I have a paper bag? Well, the option should be to get a plastic bag, not the other way around. And when I wrote to Baker's Delight, they said, oh, everybody wants plastic to keep their bread fresh. And I thought, that is just utterly ridiculous when most families go through bread in a day or something. So interesting that WA also, they ban most plastics, and yet Victoria and New South Wales doesn't seem to be able to do it. But it was interesting from Baker's Delight perspective, and that all of their stuff is bagged in plastic at the front, and yet they won't change it. So.
And remember, Rosemary, I've been trying to find a really old school farmhouse looking one. But remember, we would all have growing up, we'd have, I want to call them bread trays, bread containers, you know, like on the bench.
They won't do it. And it was just adamant that they just said people want plastic to keep their bread fresh. And I don't know where they get their stats from. But, and no one says, you know, none of the girls are told, do you want, you know, a bag first and then you opt for plastic, which, you know, it just shows there is no concern with big companies. So it's a bit sad.
Good on you, Rosemary. This has come in from Kate and it says, excellent discussion. Thank you for raising the issue. Can we please add Chupa Chup sticks to the list? I pick up so many from everywhere, including the beach, along with other loads of plastic that's everywhere. Lollipop sticks were actually on your list, Hayley, weren't they?
They were, and it is one of those items that traditionally they weren't plastic, and, you know, there's been talk about putting them back to a bamboo stick, for example. But just a little note on those ones, if you look on the end of what you think is a Chupa Chup stick and you see three little ridges on each end, it's actually a cotton bud stick, which Victoria has addressed in their single-use phase-out. So, yeah, sometimes the Chupa Chup sticks and the cotton bud sticks, they can filter through in our stormwater drains and they're very easily found on a lot of beaches.
The rise of how many berries we eat in life now, like, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, even the 90s, berries weren't as common. They weren't as everyday. They were kind of for special times. Now, they're every day. They're going to the school lunches. You might have them at your desk at work. But the packets are all plastic. I did see some cardboard plastics, and the little window into the strawberries, I think it was, said that this plastic window is also recyclable. I didn't know whether or not to believe what I was reading. That was the other thing, Hayley. What about berry punnets? Was that on your list of 15 problematic items?
Not ending up in the litter stream as much, but definitely those supermarket packaging items. Like there's so many things to address. One of the items or one of the things that we were looking at with packaging like that is what's called non-functional slack filling. And you may never have heard that term, but you've probably seen it. And when it's when you open a product and you see more air than product in it, and you know there's no reason for that extra air except to make it feel like you're buying more than you actually or getting more than you actually are. So when we look at packaging, it's not only about the item, it's about how much or how many different types of plastic are in that item, which makes it difficult to recycle, but it's also how much extra air is in there that has no functional reason.
Is that like when you open a packet of crisps and you're like, what? Why is there only a handful of chips down the bottom and yet the bag feels so big and is so big? I mean, that's a whole other discussion as well. Alison's just reminded me they were called bread bins. Thank you, Alison. They were. As the director and CEO of Tangaroa Blue Foundation, Heidi, and working in this space of marine rubbish and plastic pollution, are we making significant change or does it just sort of come in and out of our psyche and our list of things that are important to us in terms of making real change? And we often just fall back to bad habits and people come up with workarounds in order to get around the ban. So plastic bags, for example.
I think that it can always be overwhelming at how much further we have to go. But if you turn around and look back from where we've come from, like when I first started Tangaroa Blue in 2004, only one state had a container deposit scheme and people thought I was talking about driftwood when I was talking about marine debris. So, you know, over the last 20 years, all states now have container deposit schemes. We have single-use plastic bans. We have plastic policy embedded at state and federal level. So I think that there are still a lot of things that we can do, but we have come a really long way. What we do need to see now is that all of these state policies are aligned at a national level. It's much easier for a big business to be able to do something blanket across the country rather than having to do special packaging items for each different state. So I think that we just need to see that national alignment. Now we're all on the same page that we need to reduce plastics.
Absolutely. And lots of people saying where they go, and in particular in South Australia, the bread tags are paper or cardboard, so it can be done. Is that okay? I'm presuming, can be recycled unless they're covered in a wax or something?
Yeah, I mean, if they're a normal cardboard product, they can. I would just say that most recycling systems have a kind of like a size limit. So to make sure cardboard items get, like any item gets recycled, you probably want to put them in a bigger cardboard container or box or something like that to make sure they don't slip through during that recycling process.
We've spoken at length on this program about fruit stickers. It gets quite heated very quickly in terms of whether or not we need them, Heidi. And many people say, well, how else am I going to identify my apples? You know, is this a Granny Smith or is it a Golden Delicious? And is it a Pink Lady or is it a Red Gala? And all of the solutions around there, from laser tags to just electronic signs. Can we just do away with those blasted fruit stickers that end up everywhere?
Please, please. Yep. And especially those pieces of fruit where you end up with three of them on the one.
I know, because I think someone else has peeled them off and stuck them back on because they don't want to take them home.
I know. And I think now if you go to any of the major supermarkets and you put a piece of fruit on the self-checkouts, the AI now is getting pretty good to identify what you've actually got on your scales. Like it'll give you two or three different items. So I think that technology continues to evolve. You know, that recognition of what that item is will continue to get more and more accurate. There is research done onto the laser etching, which doesn't damage the fruit as well. So I think technology is getting us to the point now where we can say we don't need them anymore for sure.
The idea that you're confident and you're excited about these changes actually makes me excited, Heidi. I guess my final question is, can we just copy what you're doing? Like, can Victoria take your research? Can it take all of your hard work? And can it implement some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah, like the threat and risk assessment that was done in New South Wales. Like, it was a collaboration between local government, state government. It was researchers, academia. It was the NGO sector. You know, we took really good data and we used that. And the framework exists. Now, in each state, they have different marine assets. They have different marine litter signatures. But we have all of that information. It's kind of like plugging it into the framework and working from there. And I think that if we start to really use the data to guide where we need to go, because we know the marine debris issue and the litter issue in Cape York is completely different to what you find in Port Phillip Bay. So we can't have a one-size-fits-all solution. But if we can use the data to guide it, we'll start to see much, much better impact.
Thank you for your work and for your dedication in this space, because things do need to change. We just get used to, you know, the status quo won't work anymore, and there's nothing more confronting than seeing the image of the insides of a seabird and the fact that, you know, 80% of its insides and its gizzards is plastic as opposed to organs and all of the things that it needs. And that's our doing. And they're the things that we need to change. Heidi, thank you.
Thank you.
Heidi Tate, who is the director and the CEO of Tangaroa Blue Foundation. Maybe you've made those small changes. Lots of people saying, yep, our local baker, that's where we go. It's in paper. Another saying, we all survived before plastic was invented. This, Rish, I don't need a little fruit sticker to tell me what I'm eating. And the bread ties, they can be made with paper as well. But Patrick says, bear in mind that extra air in the bag of crisps also prevents crushing during transport and handling. Ooh, see, that's true. There's nothing worse than opening the chips and they're all just crumpled at the bottom. You want those big, fresh crisps. But at the same time, there is an air of disappointment, if you don't mind the pun there, when you open up a big bag of chips and that's only a quarter full. Don't get me started on chips. Coming up in just a moment, are you ready for Stranger Things? Season 5, the final season, kicks off today. Have you been watching it from the beginning? Did you go back and re-watch it? Are you coming in at season 5? There is so much talk around the world about this particular release. So what are they doing differently? And are they making us kind of watch TV like we used to in the 80s, where you wait for something to come out, where it's a moment where you sit with friends or with family members and you watch TV together?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, in our household, we've gone back to season 1 of Stranger Things, and I love it as much this time as I did however many years ago it was released. There's just something special about a coming of age meets monsters coming out of your wall show. But Stranger Things season 5, the final season, is launching today. It's reportedly the most expensive season of a television series ever filmed. The budget I've been reading is anywhere between 400 and 480 million US, which translates to about 50 or 60 million US per episode. But how they're releasing it is different. You know, you can't binge it. It's being released in what they call a volume and different volumes. So it's event style watching, like when you were waiting for, you know, the last episode of A Country Practice and everyone spoke about it and TV Week put it on their front cover and it was all leading up to this particular event. You had to wait for it. You had to sit on the couch. You had to sit with your nan or your mum or your dad or your siblings or your friends to watch this event. Is that what they're doing again? Peter Matesi, creator of Return to Paradise, which is now streaming on iView. Peter, you've worked on so many different TV shows and series over the years. So before we talk about how you end one, right, and what do? You kill off your darling, or how do you end it well and keep everybody happy? The way we're going back to watching TV now kind of feels nostalgic in a way. I feel like we're sitting on the couch and watching telly again like we used to when we were growing up.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? It makes me really excited, actually. When I saw the billboard for Stranger Things and, you know, the volumes and then the finale on New Year's Day, what TV, as we know, in the last 20 years has become so fragmented. Even, you know, going back to the 80s when we had four channels or five channels and that was it. And, you know, then we had Foxtel and we had more channels and more options, and now there's so many options. And so you can see TV broadcasters and streamers, they're desperate to get those things that are an event. They're kind of desperate to get those things that old TV used to have, where everyone is watching it at the same time, and they're trying really hard to create it. And Game of Thrones did it quite unusual in this era for a show to be that big. And Stranger Things is that as well. Like, it is a real event. And Netflix, it's unusual for them to not dump everything at the same time. To actually spread it out like this is unusual for them. So I think they're trying really hard
to get away from binging.
And to get everyone enjoying it together.
And I'm with you. I'm quite excited about it. And we've been doing it ourselves. I mean, we've gone back to series one. But I'm also just enjoying sitting on the couch with my family and watching an actual TV, not watching TV in inverted commas on my phone or on a screen, and not in silos in separate rooms, watching it on an actual TV.
Yeah, I know.
Together.
At the time that it is on.
Yeah.
That is something that we've had with Return to Paradise as well. A lot of people say to me that we all watch it together as a family, that the kids all watch it, and not the kids endure it or I endure the kids' shows, but actually we all sit there and enjoy the same show at the same time. And murder mystery being murder mystery, we all have everyone, it's interactive, right? So everyone's got theories about who did it and what they're concealing and what the story is. And that, just anecdotally, people coming to talk to me, that is a really significant thing because it doesn't happen very often. Everyone's on their own device watching their own thing. And we've forgotten, I think, what really makes television magical. And I think it's not the content. I even hate the word content. It's not the shows so much as it is, it's in our lounge room and everyone's watching it in their lounge room at the same time. And of course, it's not the 1960s anymore. We've all got one TV in the house. Everyone's got 15 screens in the house. But that's what makes TV so great. And that's what, you know, Netflix is spending, what do you reckon, $50 million an episode, $40 million an episode or something.
US.
To do this. I have some familiarity with television budgets. I don't know how you spend that much money.
No.
I literally can't figure out where it goes. Your cast get very expensive, obviously, as it goes on. They just name their price. So that gets expensive. Visual effects, I guess, for something like Stranger Things are very expensive, and you spend a lot of time on it. But, wow, that's a lot of money to spend.
It really is. It really, and I do want to chat to you about how you end something. But when we look at the revival of watching TV like we did in the 80s, so in the one room together on an actual TV. And then you couple that alongside the social media ban, which is about to come in like, what, a week's time or something. I actually wonder, like, I found myself even saying to my daughter, get off your screens and go and watch some TV, which sounds ridiculous, right?
Yeah, but an old-fashioned wholesome activity, like go and watch TV.
Exactly.
When I was a kid, it was stop watching TV and get out in the park.
100%.
I was like, TV, I'd love them to watch TV. That'd be great.
I feel like it's a parental win when she's actually just watching the telly and not on a small screen.
I think it is a parental win because I'm obviously, because of what I do for a living, I'm very keen on my kids engaging with stories. Mm. And so watching endless YouTube clips of soccer tricks.
Different.
Great. And great fun when you play futsal on a Sunday morning and you've got a whole lot of soccer tricks up your sleeve. But it's different to actually engaging with a story. And my 10-year-old at the moment is watching old episodes of The Simpsons. Like, I came out the other day and it was the one where Sideshow Bob framed Krusty and got Krusty locked up. And I'm like, I used to watch this when I was 10. And here we are watching it again. It's still a great story. And anything that gets people, not even just kids, anything that gets people engaging with a story, I think is a great thing. And so Stranger Things, not my type of show. Who cares?
Yeah.
Because millions and millions of people are engaging with this story and being really enthusiastic about a story, which is different to looking at your phone on Instagram.
Yeah, that's right, and just watching reel after reel. Peter Matesi is with you, creator of Return to Paradise, which is now streaming on iView. We're talking about the final and fifth season of Stranger Things and just how they're doing it differently and event TV and how we used to watch it. This is a great text. Me and my mates used to rush home every Sunday afternoon to watch Baywatch in the 90s. And I know, remember Tuesday Night's a Bitch, Peter Matesi? When it was
Melrose Place?
Melrose Place and 90210 back to back. Oh,
I mean, what a double act.
And so we would get together as mates in our 20s and be like, okay, who's hosting Tuesday night? It was a thing. And you would sit around and watch it.
I don't want to get too old fashioned, but we are, given the way the world is now and phones and social media and all that stuff, we do seem to be craving those things that connect us as people, whether that be live music, or even a TV show that you can share with people, it feels like this is something that has slipped down or minimised a little bit in our society, where it's a human thing to want that, and we're craving it again. And so sometimes TV shows feed it, sometimes viewing parties feed it, sometimes live music feeds it, whatever it is, we want to get together for these things, which is why you see these streamers investing so heavily in sport, because sport is, you've got to watch it when it's on. It's not something that you can catch up on a year later or a day later even. You've got to watch it. You know, the cricket.
That's so true.
Travis Head on Saturday night, we got our ratings back about Return to Paradise, and it's like, well, we're a bit down on Saturday night because everyone was watching Trav go bananas in the Ashes. And
see, everyone's been complaining about free-to-air footy not being on a Saturday night, but that's a win for you, right? Because people start flicking around and watching.
That's a win for us, yeah, except when Travis Head plays the end of his life.
So how do you end a series, Peter Mattesi, as someone who's written for everything from Neighbours to Return of Paradise? I mean, there's a text here from Seb in Richmond, and it says, the best last episode I ever saw and still to this day is 6 Feet Under. I sometimes still go back and watch that episode. It's simply the best. How do you go about ending something?
That's a very hard question. Look, I think as a writer, if you're storytelling, you've got something. Once you start a story, the way you tell it is defined by the ending. You know, it's very unusual that you start a story and you don't know how it's going to finish. Now, I don't mean you know exactly how it's finished, but you know if your story starts with boy meets girl, then they're probably going to end up together at the end, depending on how you tell that story. If you're telling Annie Hall, they don't end up together at the end, so the way you tell the story will be different. So I think, I can't speak for the Stranger Things guys, but I expect you start that story and you have an idea of what the end is.
Right at the beginning.
I think you do. I know that Amy Sherman-Palladino, Gilmore Girls, she knew the last lines of dialogue that she had up her sleeve for the end of that series. I can't even remember if she got to execute them or not. But she had, she knew how much detail she was going to have. Something like Seinfeld, which is not, you know, it's an episodic thing where each episode you reset and it's like the last episode didn't even happen, really.
Yeah, they stuffed that completely.
That's a much more difficult thing to finish because you're not ending a story that you've begun. You're just bringing a setup to a close. And so I think that type of thing is like a lot harder. But anything that has an overarching narrative to it or a central story to it, you would think the storytellers have an idea of how that is going to finish.
Wow. I wonder
whether they stick to that idea.
Yeah, and whether or not people are going to be happy.
And now they're in 5 and Netflix say, look, we're opening the checkbook for another series. Can you
change
your ending?
I wonder what they'll do next. I wonder what the brothers will do next. I mean, whatever they want, pretty much.
Whatever they want. They can just chill out and relax and buy a boat. Just
roll around in buckets of cash.
Exactly. I mean, and it is a lot of money, obviously. I don't know what they're getting paid, but out of a $400 million budget, you know, there's a piece of it that's theirs. It's millions of dollars. But when you think of the type of money that people get for inventing an app that, you know, has some users in tech, the amount of money that they get is nothing compared to that. Yeah. But also what they have done, when you think about it, is created a piece of art that has brought so many people together and enjoyed. As a writer, I think that's the greatest thing you can do. Like, they should get paid the most money because that's a priceless experience to have brought all those people together. I think the same thing about Taylor Swift. Everyone's like, Taylor Swift made this many.
It's a very similar energy, isn't it? Yeah.
So she should make that much money. Anyone went to that gig, it was, you know, she brought the most joyful night of their lives to millions of people around the world. That's invaluable. And so, whatever they earned, it's worth it.
It's a segue I wasn't expecting, but I'm there for it. And it's just reminded me just finally, Peter Mattesi, of the Sunday night movie. And it was always like, oh, I wonder what the Sunday night movie will be. You know, and you would get together and you'd watch it, even if it was a little bit crap. You'd be like, but it's the Sunday night movie. That's what you do. It's how you end your week.
I talked to my 10-year-old through this about when you missed a movie at the movies, what the process was. It wasn't just it's on streaming next week, we'll watch it then. here was, you got to wait for it to be on video, and then it's on new release, right? So they're hard to get. But then you got to wait for it to go to weekly, and then maybe 18 months later it's on TV, and you can tape it and have it forever. And he just couldn't get it's his like, head around
what?
That.
I know. And then you try and get the deal. Remember where you get the 10 videos DVDs because it was cheaper, but you'd never watch them all?
School holidays. Yeah. 10 weeklies for $10. Get down there. And so that type of thing where you all sit and enjoy something together is vanishingly rare now. So we need to, you know, grab onto it and cherish it when it comes.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And there was an art into making your way around Blockbuster or Video Easy and knowing which section to go to. Peter, always good to chat with you, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, yourself.
See ya. Peter Matesi is the creator of Return to Paradise. That, of course, is streaming now. But Stranger Things, the final and fifth season, it's launching in the US last night, here today. Huge budget. This text has come in from Laura. Now, Laura, I am no expert. However, your question of Stranger Things sounds really good. I haven't watched it. There's a lot of talk about families watching it together. Can you please comment on the age appropriateness of it, e.g. What age kids this would be suitable for, not suitable for? My 12-year-old is watching it and enjoying it. Bits of it are scary, but what she's connecting with is the fact that the kids are 12, because we're watching season one, and I can really see her leaning into that coming of ageness of it. I would watch it with them because, you know, monsters do come out of the wall and some crazy things happen. So I don't know, give it a shot and see how you go, but I am no expert. I could be completely messing my child up and I have no idea. So give it a go. Coming up in just a moment, we are going to speak to a basketball legend who's just been inducted into the Hall of Fame. However, as you may have heard in the news at the top of the hour, police have spoken to an 11-year-old boy after a stabbing at a primary school in Melbourne's outer southeast. The school was placed into lockdown at around 9 a.m. this morning, and police say a child was treated by paramedics for non-life-threatening injuries. A woman has also suffered minor injuries during this incident, and police have said that the 11-year-old was not taken into custody, but investigations are continuing. So if anything changes there, we'll bring it to you straight away. But up next, we're going to meet a basketball legend.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
So Australian basketball great Brendan Joyce will be inducted tonight into Victoria University's Hall of Fame. Now, Brendan, if you don't know, look, his list is so long, I literally would be here all day giving it to you, but let me give you some of the tops. So 200 NBL games during the 80s. He went on to be the head coach of the Opals as well as an assistant coach for the Boomers at several Olympic Games. He is one of our most accomplished basketball figures. Also, on top of all of that, he completed his Bachelor of Arts in Recreation at VU. So an elite player, an elite coach, an incredible mark on both the sport here locally as well as internationally. Brendan Joyce, a huge congratulations. I only sort of scraped the surface with your list of accolades. It's just too long, but mate, congratulations on being inducted.
Thank you. Pretty proud to be, actually. Yeah, interesting time at Victoria University, because I was actually an electrician for 8 years before I jumped into, you know, increasing my studies. It's been so helpful, though.
Well, I mean, I want to talk about that, but the other thing of how much we've just seen sport, whether it be basketball or football, you name it, change over the years. I mean, when you started out playing basketball, you were also a working electrician, right? So how things have changed.
Yeah, it was. Look, it just became too difficult. In the mid 80s, the game became more professional. And if I needed to try and stay at that level, I really had to give up my job. I wasn't making a lot of money playing basketball, but just enough. Probably less than one of us being an electrician. But, you know, the sacrifices were there. I really wanted to make the World Cup in 86 in the Olympics, which I didn't do as a player. I just missed. But look, the experience going back to uni was just enormous. I think really improved as a player.
Really?
It's been so good as a coach. Yeah, and as a coach, my whole career, I've tried to encourage players to study. And, you know, it's becoming the thing now, as you know, in professional sports and elite sports, to trying to get the players to focus on something else. And I learned that early days.
Absolutely. I was talking to Bob Murphy, our breakfast host, and of course everybody knows him as a footballer, but that thing of what you do after, right? So when you finish being a sports person, that you've got to be more than a sports person so that that going into retirement, which is when we talk retirement, sometimes we're talking like 25, 26 years of age, like you've got to have that next thing, don't you?
Yeah, and it's been interesting. I had that, and I went into study, obviously, recreation. I originally wanted to be a PE teacher. Once I got into the rec course, I didn't transfer because I thought there were broader opportunities. You know, I might want to work for the sport and recreation department at the time for the government planning, but I ended up utilising that. I used it for coaching, but I've tried to explain to coaches, and I've had success with some players to study because it gives them balance. It takes your mind off the highs and lows in respect to, you know, not getting too high, not getting too low, and gives them a focus. And I think it helps you, you know, play to a higher level with that focus somewhere else. That's what I've experienced. But like I said, you know, I've sat down with parents, and some parents have supported it, and some backed out at the last minute saying, oh, you know, my kid just wants to be a great basketball player. And that was disappointing because everywhere I went, I'd connected with universities to arrange scholarships for players, and some did it and some didn't.
Well, and that's how we do it differently here versus the United States, of course, when it comes to college basketball. But we're seeing a rise and rise of that, Brendan Joyce, and it's something that you must have witnessed the change. I mean, even the fact that we all, when I say we all, if you're a basketball fan, you might often find yourself watching college basketball, right? When Caitlin Clark was the talk of the town when she was still playing college basketball and not so-called, you know, not with a team as such. Did you ever imagine that people in Australia or in other countries would just be streaming and watching college basketball, that you would have local players, you know, playing out in Bulleen or in Bendigo saying, oh, yeah, I want to play American college basketball one day? Like, it's just gone gangbusters.
Yeah, it's certainly taken off. But I'll share a little story with you because it's quite funny. Back in the early days in the NBL in the off-season, we used to tour the US to try out our Americans, our imports. And at the time, we played Texas Tech, and I remember Colorado State University, and they went up to the coach and they said, oh, we want to recruit your player for college. And he started laughing.
Wow.
So he came up, he said, I'll just let you know, you play pretty well in these games. These colleges won't recruit you, but I've had to let them know you're 28 years old.
This is the thing, right?
Yeah, so, you know, it's just at that point in time, I look back and I think, what if I only was able to visit, you know, and play in front of those colleges, late 70s, early 80s, you know, it's I probably would have jumped at the chance to go to college.
Absolutely. Yeah. You've also spoken, you're listening to Brendan Joyce, who tonight is going to be inducted into VU's Sport Hall of Fame. And, I mean, maybe this has got to do with education alongside being an elite sports person, but you've spoken a lot about managing your emotions on the court. How much of that is a formula to success just in sport in generally, where you can be the tallest, you can be the fastest, you know, you can have just good genes, but if your emotional intelligence, if your brain's, you know, if your brain's not switched on, is that like the key? Is that the missing element, do you think?
Yeah, I think when I think of emotion, I think my intensity levels were over the top. You know, I was definitely suffering from white line fever. I think that was the era where, you know, you had to display toughness, you had to display, you know, some type of emotion to you know, demonstrate the love of the game. But it was a distraction. But I, you know, in studying psychology at the university, it started to get me to think about, you know, how my own emotions in respect to not just for me, my teammates, my coach, and obviously, you know, it's pretty important to have that emotional intelligence, especially as a coach, because you're going to deal with players that are dealing with highs and lows, and they've set their own goals, and they're, you know, they're failing, they're succeeding, and managing all that. But as a player, I really believe while I was attending university in particular, I started in 85, immediately after 6 months, I think it was the second semester I started to do psychology. And I would apply some of it to myself in respect to maintaining balance. And I played my best basketball as a mature age player, not only a mature age student from 25 onwards till
when I retired.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, it equipped me with those skills. I mean, I just didn't have that knowledge. I mean, as a Sparky, you're studying to make sure you don't burn someone's house down or connecting PowerPoints, and you know, you're not touching the people side. The other part of it was because I wanted to do a PE degree, I did a lot of electives, so I did a lot of PE subjects in physiology and human biology, so I got to understand my body more and took care of myself professionally. So without knowing, I was becoming a high performance manager of myself, which is, you know, I have that ability today to manage people in that area. So, but you know, at that point in time, it was more about how can I improve and reach the goals that I wanted to achieve.
I mean, it's interesting when you talk about all of those subjects. It's sort of just taken me back to the 90s, because I actually studied performance at VU, and we were on the same campus as the PE students, and you couldn't have two more diverse crowds, right? Your drama students and your rec students. But we would do the same classes every now and then. We would do biology, for example, because we as performers needed to understand how our body worked and moved in the same way that the PE students needed to understand as well. So the crossover, sometimes it was, I mean, you could tell by clothes, let's face facts, you know, there was us in our Doc Martens and pyjamas, and then you'd have the PE kids in their sporty stuff. But that crossover was there. Brendan Joyce, just finally, how do you see the current state of grassroots basketball at the moment? It feels like it's thriving, but I just wonder whether we have enough stadiums, whether we're encouraging a diverse background of people to be able to play basketball, whether that be age, gender, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Are you happy with the state of grassroots at the moment?
Yeah, look, again, you bring back so many memories by asking these questions. Even in the early days, we didn't get paid a lot, but we did a lot for the grassroots. I even went into some of the prisons, you know, with young kids.
Wow.
I can't remember the name of the prison around Royal Park, but it was a teenage prison, to do some clinics and talk to them, and it was quite popular. But in respect to, you know, going into schools and all that, we did that back then. I think that was the beginning of it. But today, the game's taken off in respect to stadiums. I mean, Victoria leads the way. You know, the amount of stadiums in Victoria, they're always crying out for more because the population is growing that wants to play basketball. But, you know, I've lived in New South Wales and Queensland, and, you know, New South Wales improved. Queensland still don't have enough stadiums in respect to providing, you know, those opportunities for kids, and associations are having to pay too much for their court hire, whereas Victoria associations can actually own their facilities. But in respect to opportunities for kids, I've had the pleasure of coaching quite a few Sudanese kids. They've been awesome. You know, two of them have gone on to play with the South Sudanese Olympic team.
Wow.
Kwani Kwani, who was the captain, and Denga Kuth. I had, you know, there's a little stint where I coached Ballarat for 3 years, and I had those two fellas, so I'm quite proud of that. So I've got to know a bit of the South Sudanese community. There is a lot going on to support different communities and different genders in basketball.
Gosh, what haven't you done? Brendan, what a celebration that it's going to be tonight. Congratulations again, and we wish you all the best, and I hope you get a chance to soak it all in tonight and to enjoy it all. We might have to get you back on another time. We love talking grassroots sports here, so we might get you back another time.
Oh, I appreciate it. I just written my speech. It's just, you know, I just want to thank people. I mean, as far as you know, the achievements go, they are what they are, and I think tonight for me is to celebrate the people that have helped me.
Thank you so much, Brendan. Enjoy tonight.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
See ya. Brendan Joyce, Australian basketball great. Tonight, he will be inducted into the VU Sport Hall of Fame. Wow. Gosh, some people just achieve so much and they're just so modest at the same time. Coming up in just a moment, there are lots of award ceremonies, whether it be the Arias, the Grammys, the Logies. Well, TikTok have now got their own awards. Some of those who have won, some of those who have been mentioned in about a week's time, won't even be able to go onto the platform. So how is that going to work? That's next.
The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
At the beginning of the program, we were talking about some of those small plastics and how we could potentially get rid of them in New South Wales. They are implementing everything from bread tags to fruit stickers to little pizza stools. They're called something else, but they look like stools, you know, the little white things. So what are we doing here? And, you know, what changes can we make so that marine life doesn't suffer? And gosh, this is just so sad. Kim in the Yarra Valley sent this message saying, my friend found a large dead sea sea turtle on the beach just recently. He's been a beachgoer for over 50 years. He has never seen this before. My thoughts were, does it have a belly full of plastics? Well, unfortunately, the answer is probably yes, and we're seeing that with seabirds as well, which is why all this work's being done to try and stop us using all of those small plastics. But gosh, that would be so confronting to see a dead turtle on the beach. But we know there are lots of awards and award ceremonies out there that celebrate culture, everything from music to film to you name it. But now we've had so for a couple of years, the TikTok Awards. They happened last night. Sophie Monk was hosting. Dr. Stephen Conway, Senior Lecturer and Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne. Did TikTok just create these awards themselves? Let's have an award ceremony to pat ourselves on the back. But it was watched last night by millions of people all around the world.
It was indeed. You know, it's always one of those questions where you ask yourself, who are these millions of people and what platforms are they watching on? I know we had it live on Stan in Australia, but, you know, the claims remain that it's bot-driven engagement, that it's being watched online by quote-unquote subscribers to TikTok. So I'm not quite sure where the metrics are in that number.
But the worlds have kind of collided when you look at someone like Sophie Monk, who was hosting it. The British actor Jonathan Bailey made an appearance. People would know him from Wicked. So it's sort of using other mediums and people that are already known in other areas, what, to legitimise what it does? Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe what it does is legitimate now. I mean, millions of people are on it, using it, and now they have awards to celebrate it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Rochelle. It is an effort to legitimise. It's to borrow the cultural value of those associations of Jonathan Bailey in film and television, Sophie Monk and so on, to say, well, if they're legitimate and they're associating themselves with this event, then therefore, by that process, surely this is legitimate, especially when you look at the video of the year for TikTok and you go, I have no idea why that has any value whatsoever. It's just a girl looking into her phone for 12 seconds. And I think rightly a lot of folks who don't use TikTok would go, why does that have any merit or value? I have no understanding of this medium.
I had a look through of those who won, though, and I'm not on TikTok. I probably should be, just to keep across things. But I was surprised at the age of people who were winning. They were older, they were men, you know, it wasn't teens doing some little dance, which is how the platform started. There were families that were all involved. We've already heard of some Australian families who are seriously considering moving overseas so they can keep their YouTube channel and their TikTok channel up and running, because the kids, as of next week, are going to be banned from the platform. So there's something bizarre going on when one of the dads won, and his kids are a part of it. But from next week, his kids won't be able to be on TikTok. How will that work, Stephen?
Well, I don't think it will work, will it, in Australia at least? Yes, so I think those concerns are very valid for them if they're making a living, which I'm sure they are from this. So it's going to cause a lot of disruption in the space, I feel, when those who are supposed to be the main viewers, the main subscribers, the main posters are all of a sudden not even allowed access to the platform. So that's going to be a real big problem for TikTok to surmount.
Well, TikTok shift, will it become and slowly morph into being a YouTube as such, not necessarily being a platform for kids and teens? We already know musicians use it. You know, there was the guy with the sexy sourdough, whoever he is. You know, that's not for kids. So will it morph into something else?
Well, firstly, funnily enough, I think a lot of kids are watching those quote-unquote sexy videos, and that's, of course, part of the government's issue with it. But yeah, I think it will morph slowly but surely. I'm not sure how much impact, you know, the Australian legislation will have globally, because, of course, it's a drop in the puddle. It's a massive ocean they've got, TikTok. But I think it is changing. I think it is developing. You know, some of the award winners, I think you would put in front of anyone who has never encountered social media, and they would say, oh, that's funny, for example. For the comedy creator, it's adults acting as children. And you say, oh, I see what's wrong here, what the weirdness is. I get the joke. It's a violation of what we expect adults to behave like. Ha, ha, ha. But then there are those videos, such as the video of the year, which is something that is innately TikTok. It could only ever exist as a TikTok video, because if you trace the lineage of TikTok, what is its closest sibling? Well, it would probably be sketch shows and adverts from the 80s and 90s is, I think, the closest you could explain it to anyone. You'd say, well, you know how adverts used to be 20 seconds and they had to get an image across, they had to get an idea across. That's TikTok. And so there's, I think, traditionally, those formats have very little cultural value. I don't think any of us say, oh, adverts are the height of art, or sketch shows. Do you remember 1990s blah blah sketch? Someone would say, I can't remember a sketch from last year.
Who was the girl with the chewy? And she was
Leah Harton.
No, the sketch shows. Kylie Mole. That's what I remember.
That's I'm of the English Harry Enfield generation.
Google Kylie Mole. It'll change your life. Just finally,
is she on TikTok?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. Dr. Stephen Conway, just finally, as the Senior Lecturer and Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne, next week the ban comes in, the social media ban comes in. Are we going to feel it? Will the universe shift and shake a little bit? Will we all just stop there and go, what just happened?
Not even slightly. Honestly, Rochelle, not even slightly. You know, the digital natives who use these platforms will have various, very easy, accessible ways of getting around and circumventing these bans. A VPN app is not hard to install to show that you're logging in from America. So I don't think it's actually going to have any effect whatsoever, sadly.
Dr. Stephen Conway, always good to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Rochelle.
CLN Lecturer and Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.